This time on your weekly Constitutional.
I think what listeners may not know as often is when we're talking about overruling Roe, we're not really talking anymore about the version set down by the Supreme Court in 1973. We're really talking about Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which came down in 1992. And interestingly enough, Casey came down at a time when, much like now, when everyone was expecting a court stocked with conservative justices to overturn Roe, and the court instead kind of transformed it.
That was Mary Ziegler at Florida State University. It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's Abortion Update 2019.
It's time for your weekly Constitutional, a weekly discussion of interesting constitutional issues from gay rights to gun rights, produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier, and is hosted by Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Abortion is, of course, a very constitutional subject and one that we've talked about several times on this show. These days, you can't avoid it because red state after red state is passing greater and greater restrictions on abortion. Some of these restrictions very clearly violate current Supreme Court case law, and they're very clearly designed to challenge that case law. Indeed, some people have been very blunt about their motives. They want to overturn Roe versus Wade. Of course, that would take a vote of the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court has had some very significant changes in membership over the last couple of years. So will the court reverse Roe? Will these attempts succeed? Have we been here before? Our guest today knows a lot about the subject, and she's going to take us all the way back to before Roe versus Wade so that we can understand what's happening today.
I'm Mary Ziegler. I'm a law professor at Florida State University College of Law, and I write on the legal history of abortion. I'm three books in, so
oh my
do
goodness.
A lot of it.
Well, my wife would not forgive me if I failed to say, go Noles. And Florida State is, of course, a football powerhouse for those who are not clued into that. And my wife is a proud graduate. And she hates nothing more, she says, than a hurricane or a gator. Okay, now that I have done my family duty, we're speaking today because of your expertise on the subject of abortion and because abortion has been so much in the headlines. Could we just sort of do an overall view of the law regarding abortion? Casey and Roe, for example, we'll start there. And then let's talk about some of the more recent developments and how they fit into that legal framework.
Sure. Most listeners, I think, when they've read recently about the abortion debate, often what's discussed is the fate of Roe v. Wade, which was the sort of iconic, and actually it's quite documented, best known United States Supreme Court decision that legalized abortion in the United States, recognized abortion as a kind of privacy right that belonged to a woman and her physician. And that made it quite difficult for states to regulate abortion, especially earlier in pregnancy. I think what listeners may not know as often is when we're talking about overruling Roe, we're not really talking anymore about the version set down by the Supreme Court in 1973. We're really talking about Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which came down in 1992. And interestingly enough, Casey came down at a time when, much like now, when everyone was expecting a court stocked with conservative justices to overturn Roe, and the court instead kind of transformed it. The court preserved what it called the essential holding of Roe, the idea that there was a constitutional right to abortion, and actually suggested that that right had to do not only with interests in privacy and autonomy, but also women's interests in equal treatment.
Let's go over that a little bit, Mary, shall we?
Sure.
I mean, there's an almost 20-year history there because Roe versus Wade, of course, was decided in 1973, and Casey was not until 1992. So there's a lot that went on there. Let's start with Roe itself and talk about what it did and sort of the framework that it established, and then let's progress up to Casey and talk about the changes.
Roe itself, I think, was already something that came in the middle of a polarized conflict. I think some people now argue, and including, I think, former Supreme Court justices, that Roe kind of polarized the abortion debate or even created the modern culture wars. But conflicts about abortion had begun well before Roe, and there was something similar to what you see now, a kind of state-by-state battle about what the abortion laws were going to look like. This battle was happening in state courts, in federal courts, and in state legislatures. And Roe was just a part of that bigger picture. And the court had already issued several opinions on this right to privacy, not with respect to abortion, but with respect to contraception. And some court watchers were wondering if that right would be expanded or extended to cover abortion. And we can talk more about those decisions if you want. I don't know if that's relevant.
Some sense, it really is. In fact, you can go all the way back to the early 60s in a case called Poe versus Ullman, where the court sort of punted on that issue and sent the case back on the basis of standing, which the court frequently does when it doesn't want to develop an issue. But that case came back in 65 with Griswold versus Connecticut, and that's the case that established that particular right to reproductive privacy. Could you talk a little bit about that and how it sort of pointed straight at Roe?
The sort of fate of abortion law was still unclear when Griswold came down because there were sort of two competing interpretations of Griswold at the time. One was the Griswold, which invalidated a Connecticut law, unique law actually at the time, that prohibited married couples from using birth control. So one interpretation of this new right to privacy was that Griswold was really a decision about marriage and the sort of unique importance accorded to marriage. Another interpretation was that Griswold was about the importance of being able to control childbearing, and that would apply with equal force to anyone who used birth control. And the Supreme Court validated that latter interpretation, at least seemingly, in Eisenstadt versus Baird, which was another privacy case that came down the year before Roe in 1972. And that law involved basically a distinction between married and unmarried people and made it harder for unmarried people to get access to contraceptives. And the court invalidated that law on the basis of equal protection, saying there was no rational reason to treat unmarried people and married people different in this way, but said as well that if the right to privacy means anything, and I'm paraphrasing Justice Brennan here, it means the right of the individual to decide when to bear or beget a child. So that language suggested that this right of privacy was about autonomy in childbearing decisions, and some saw that as pointing in the direction of a constitutional decision on abortion.
Right. In fact, whenever I teach those two cases, I see looks of shock on my students' faces, most of whom are in their mid to late 20s and presumably are sexually active and presumably use contraception. And they find it astonishing that either married couples or unmarried couples were prohibited from getting these, at least in one state back in the day.
Right. I mean, I think things have changed, but I think we're probably going to revisit contraception. That's become more politicized in recent years in ways I think that I initially as a historian found surprising. But
oh, well, I can't wait to hear about that. Okay. So now we're primed now. So Roe versus Wade out of Texas shows up. And what did the court, what was the issue there and what did the court decide?
Well, Roe, Norma McCorvey, was a young woman from Texas who found herself pregnant with, I think it was her third child. It was not a planned or wanted pregnancy. And she initially lied about having been raped, believing it falsely. It turned out that Texas allowed for abortions in cases of rape and incest. It did not. And she ultimately found her way to the office of Sarah Weddington, who was a young and pretty inexperienced attorney who actually had herself had an illegal abortion. So this was a sort of personal issue for her too. And Weddington wound up working with Linda Coffey, another attorney. And ultimately there was a sort of whole team of attorneys who took the case, but very much as a way to kind of test the Supreme Court's attitudes on abortion. So Weddington sought a declaration from a Texas district court that Texas's law was unconstitutional as it pertained to Norma McCorvey, or to Jane Roe, as the court would call her. And that case ultimately went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court.
And the court very famously decided by, I believe it was a 7-2 majority, wasn't it?
That it was, yeah, that's right.
Written by Justice Blackmun, that the Texas statute was, in fact, unconstitutional.
Right, and more controversially, and I think less famously, the court also held that a Georgia law, as part of a companion case called Doe v. Bolton, was unconstitutional. And the Georgia law had been some years ago seen as a sort of reform middle ground measure. So together, Roe and Doe invalidated most of the laws that were then on the books. So unlike, for example, Griswold, which affected Connecticut, and that was pretty much it, Roe had a pretty far-reaching impact, at least when it came to the laws on the books in the United States at the time.
But it was a highly unusual opinion, and it went into a great deal of history and medicine and analysis of the three trimesters of pregnancy. And so what was the rule that emerged from that remarkable opinion?
So as you mentioned, the rule came to be known as the trimester framework. So the idea was that in the first trimester of pregnancy, the state really had very little ability to regulate abortion at all. The court carved out exceptions for example, requiring that all abortions be performed by a physician, which turned out to be consequential years later. But for the most part, the state was just not allowed to regulate at all. In the second trimester, the state was allowed to advance its interest in maternal health, and only in the third trimester could the state act to protect fetal life. And that, of course, had been both fetal life and fetal personhood had been the kind of main constitutional interests invoked by the state of Texas.
Indeed.
In the case.
I often assert in my class, and I'll be interested in seeing how you feel about this assertion, that when you think human life begins, the point at which you personally believe human life begins, which is, of course, a philosophical and a theological and religious and medical and scientific, all those things, that when you personally decide when you think human life begins, it's going to be somewhere from around the point of conception, maybe even before, and then to the point of live birth. And the earlier you think human life exists, the more you're going to tend toward the so-called pro-life side of things. And the more you think it's later in pregnancy, then the more you're going to tilt toward the so-called pro-choice side. The court has never definitively said, we think this is when human life begins, but effectively they said that it's somewhere in that second trimester or perhaps at the beginning of the third.
Yeah, I mean, the court in a way kind of punted in Roe on the question of when human life begins by saying simply that there's too much disagreement, whether that disagreement be, you know, philosophical, scientific, religious, and that if the experts couldn't agree on when life began, then it wasn't within Texas's power to impose one view on that subject on anyone else, or really for the Supreme Court to do so either. And I think it also that exposed, I think, differences in how pro-choice and pro-life people were even asking that question as attorneys and as activists. For the most part, pro-choice activists and attorneys were saying that this was primarily a subjective, moral, religious, philosophical question, and that therefore there could be no objective answer to what was a subjective question. And anti-abortion or pro-life groups tended to frame the question instead as one exclusively of science, saying that how one interpreted that those scientific data was largely irrelevant, right? That humanity was a biological fact. And so in that way, the court, I think, sort of showed its hand in terms of how it was viewing this interest in protecting life. And that's been, interestingly, also not the angle that anti-abortion attorneys have taken after Roe. That part of Roe has not been the focus of as much organizing as the other holding with respect to fetal personhood, which was the other primary argument that Texas made in trying to defend its law.
Do you want to see the court overturn Roe v.
Well, if we put another two or perhaps three justices on, that's really what's going to be, will happen, and that'll happen automatically.
This was the 44th March for Life, but it held special significance for tens of thousands of anti-abortion activists with the coming of a Republican president in Congress.
I'm here for the unborn.
This year it's even more different. We're making history.
Abortion is not safe for women. Abortion is dangerous. Abortion kills women. So if they are for women, at the very least, they should want to have regulations that protect women and their safety and their health.
Because of all of you, and the many thousands who stand with us in marches like this all across the nation, life is winning again in America.
This year with President Trump and Vice President Pence, You know, there's a feeling that maybe we're going to get somewhere, that somebody's hearing us, that our voice is out there and being heard.
Life is sacred, and we should do all we can to protect it. We want to stand with the pro-life people who are here.
I will say this, it will go back to the states, and the states will then make a determination.
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today my guest is Mary Ziegler, the Stearns Weaver Miller Professor at Florida State University's College of Law. Stick around. And now let's continue our discussion with Mary Ziegler of Florida State University, who's written several books about the history of abortion. Today, she's sharing some of that information with us. So why don't you describe a little bit of the fallout and what happened between 1973 and 1992?
Well, the anti-abortion movement, as I mentioned, had already been very well organized, but Roe sort of prompted the nationalization of the movement. There hadn't really been very effective national organizations before Roe, and that began to change. It also, I think, after Roe, you saw the forging of alliances between the pro-choice and the pro-life movement and political parties, which really hadn't happened before Roe either. If you had asked someone in 1975, you know, which is the pro-life party and which is the pro-choice party, they probably would have looked at you like you were crazy, because there really wasn't an answer to that question that was coherent at that time.
No, there wasn't. So, there wasn't at all. In fact, I think that sort of parallels, doesn't it, the differences in the parties as they've evolved over the years. I mean, there were so-called liberal Republicans back in the day and conservative Democrats, and just as those categories seem to have disappeared, pro-choice Republicans and pro-life Democrats seem almost to have disappeared as well.
That's right. And I think there's a kind of complicated story behind how that happened. Even if you look at within the anti-abortion movement or within the abortion rights movement, there were Republicans and Democrats within the movements at the grassroots level, not just at, you know, kind of within the party elites. But anti-abortion groups at the beginning focused on actually formally amending the Constitution, because they understood that anything less than that would not actually ban abortions outright coast to coast. And that in part explained their involvement in politics. They knew that if sitting legislators wouldn't vote for this constitutional amendment, they had to change who was sitting in the legislators' seats. But quite quickly, it became clear that that constitutional amendment wasn't happening anytime soon. And anti-abortion groups began to set their sights on sort of short-term solutions that would keep the abortion rate down and gradually chip away at Roe. And by the time you got to the early 1980s, internal divisions within the anti-abortion movement, which are present even to this day, had doomed anything resembling a constitutional amendment and made these more kinds of incremental strategies the centerpiece of what the anti-abortion movement was doing. And instead of a constitutional amendment, anti-abortion groups set out a new goal, and that was to influence Supreme Court selections through influencing the GOP and then create it perfect test cases for a reconfigured court to overturn Roe v. Wade. So the goal was no longer changing the Constitution, it was changing the Supreme Court and undoing Roe v. Wade.
And this, this coincides with the founding of the Federalist Society, which...
Yeah, it does, and it actually, I think, probably even earlier than that.
Oh, really?
because anti-abortion lawyers weren't really, I mean, I'd have to, we should check when was the Federalist Society founded?
My recollection is around 1980.
Yeah, no, definitely before that, because you have to remember that anti-abortion lawyers prior to 1980 wouldn't necessarily have thought of themselves as conservative, right? And might have seen the Federalist Society as sort of largely irrelevant to what they were trying to do. Certainly thought that originalism wasn't necessarily sympathetic to what they were trying to do, because they wanted recognition of an unenumerated constitutional right, the right to life. They didn't want a decision saying the Constitution is silent on abortion, because that wouldn't help them very much.
Mm-hmm. So it's always more complicated than you think it is. Yeah. My producer got on right. Google and has told me that the Federalist Society was formed around 1980, but it was actually 1982. But as you point out, it has broader goals that perhaps at that time wouldn't necessarily have appealed to all anti-abortion lawyers. So curiouser and curiouser, but please go on.
Yeah, the alliance with the right and both the kind of constitutional conservatives and political conservatives in the anti-abortion movement took time to form, and it was never inevitable. And it was always sort of a marriage of convenience. I think abortion opponents recognized by the early 1980s that the path to financial stability and relevance really increasingly depended on an alliance with the right. And that was both because of the party's positions changing. It was because of the emergence of the religious right and the new right. Newly mobilized evangelical Protestants tended to be conservative on abortion, but also on a variety of other issues. And groups like the Moral Majority tended to have lots and lots of money. Early anti-abortion groups really had almost none, right? If you look at the National Right to Life Committee, which was by far the largest national anti-abortion group at the time, the group was in debt almost every year, and routinely worrying about having to close its doors. So the idea that the anti-abortion movement would become associated with conservative constitutionalism was something that wasn't preordained and kind of came into view much more gradually in the early 80s.
And as the 80s progressed and the Reagan Revolution proceeded, they got their way on a lot of Supreme Court appointments, didn't they?
They did. And this idea of a kind of gradual chipping away at Roe really seemed to be working. In part, anti-abortion groups had focused on abortion funding, including passing the Hyde Amendment, which is back in the news now. Mm-hmm. The 2020 Democratic candidates, and the Supreme Court upheld the Hyde Amendment,
which prohibits the spending of federal money for abortions.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then as Ronald Reagan and later George H.W. Bush were able to put more people on the court, there seemed to be more than enough votes to overturn Roe. And so there was sort of an arms race similar to what you see now, where states were passing almost kind of a menu of different options for the court to take in overturning Roe. Laws banning abortions except in cases of rape and incest or a threat to a woman's health or life. Guam banned pretty much all abortions, a variety of more sort of incremental restrictions. And the court in 1989 upheld a challenged Missouri law, and at least a plurality of justices, this was in a case called Webster versus Reproductive Health Services, directly criticized Roe. And that, to many anti-abortion commentators, signaled that the court was prepared to actually overturn Roe. And that set the stage for Planned Parenthood versus Casey.
And what was the issue there?
Well, Casey involved a Pennsylvania law that didn't actually really require the court to overturn or even address the fate of Roe. It was a much more sort of standard issue, incremental law. It had a mandatory counseling or informed consent provision that required women to hear information about fetal development and adoption and other matters before getting an abortion. There was a spousal notification measure. There was a waiting period. There was a parental involvement measure. And so the court was set to weigh in on the constitutionality of those provisions, but also many people expected and predicted, actually, set to overturn Roe.
And did the court do that?
No, the court kind of did the exact thing that nobody really wanted them to do. Casey was a compromise decision. So the George H.W. Bush administration, you know, sort of agonized about what the result would be in Casey. And the fear, the kind of worst nightmare, was exactly what the court did, which was a sort of neither nor kind of decision. So the court did preserve the idea of a right to choose abortion, and in fact, framed it in ways that commentators thought were more persuasive than had been the case in the Roe decision. But the court also jettisoned the trimester framework of Roe and adopted an undue burden standard that many thought would be far more forgiving from the standpoint of anti-abortion legislators and would permit many more abortion restrictions.
As I explain it to my students, and please feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, this is a decision where the court basically picked viability. Now, it didn't say it's when human life begins. It's never said that. But it picked viability as the great divide. And prior to the viability of a fetus, the general burden is on the state to regulate in ways that do not place an undue burden on a woman's right to control her reproductive health. So in other words, the woman's rights are paramount before the point of viability. After the point of viability, a state can regulate abortion to the point of prohibiting it, because now, effectively, the court has said there's another life in the room. However, the caveats are that there have to be exceptions for the woman's health or for her life. And certainly, most states would also protect her right to get rid of this in cases of rape or incest, though that's not part of the Casey decision.
Yeah, I think Casey definitely preserved viability as the dividing line. In terms of when human life begins, Casey really kind of fudges it, I think, because viability is very much clearly a part of the framework of the Casey decision. Mm-hmm. But Casey also at times, in fact, the reason Casey jettisoned the trimester framework was because the court thought that Roe had undervalued the state's interest in fetal life and had wrongly concluded that that interest began at viability or began later in pregnancy, whereas the Casey court thought that that interest was present throughout pregnancy. And I think the kind of ambivalence toward what this when life begins or when even personhood begins was the most clearly on display when the court discussed this informed consent measure that Pennsylvania had introduced. Mm-hmm. And the court there said that this measure was constitutional in part because it would protect women's health. And the argument there was that women wouldn't necessarily know what an abortion involved when it came to its impact on life in the womb, and that as a result, they would suffer psychological trauma and regret. It's sort of hard to reconcile that with the idea that what's in the womb is not human until viability, right? It's like, I think that the Casey court didn't want to settle that question because probably the justices didn't have a clear answer in their own minds, but the opinion itself feels kind of contradictory and has contradictory images in it when it comes to when fetal life begins and whether that's a question that one can answer objectively. Casey says no at various points, but then sounds as if the justices think otherwise.
Yeah, both Casey and Roe were complicated and nuanced, and I've always respected at least the attempt that the court made on both occasions to address that complexity and to acknowledge that complexity. And it seems to me that that's what's missing from a great deal of the political debate over abortion. People express great certainty as to the precise moment when a human life begins, and I just have not seen that on the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think it's a reflection of how the politics have taken shape. And even the politics, it's one often sees, including there is a recent NPR PBS NewsHour poll released just several weeks ago, documenting that many Americans, a majority of Americans, have kind of conflicted gray area views when it comes to abortion, that many want Roe v. Wade to be preserved, many believe that there is a right to abortion, but many still approve of certain restrictions, and that can be true in ways that seem entirely contradictory. Just to use one example, a majority of Republican men and nearly a third of people who define themselves as pro-life favor an exception for rape and incest and abortion, which seems bizarre, but people's views are complex and the politics of abortion are not, because the politics of abortion reflect the demands of the pro-choice or pro-life movements and not necessarily of a majority of Americans who find themselves sort of in the middle on this issue. And I think the Supreme Court has tried more often to grapple with that fact and to grapple with the reasons behind that fact, which are that this is an incredibly complicated issue constitutionally, but also, you know, medically and philosophically.
Yep. Well, just as we found ourselves in the 1980s with a shift in court personnel, we find ourselves in a similar situation today with two recent Supreme Court appointments, and that seems to have energized the anti-abortion movement. And now we find ourselves in the environment where we are getting all sorts of new laws, many of them very restrictive of abortion, and many of them clearly designed to challenge both Roe and Casey. So can you talk a little bit about where we find ourselves?
Well, I think there were always actually absolutist efforts to radically and quickly change the law. So one of the more familiar laws to listeners will be the so-called heartbeat bills, which ban abortion usually around the sixth week of pregnancy. And the model for those laws, the blueprint for those laws, was actually formulated in 2011. So what's changed isn't the strategy. What's changed is the fact that so many state legislatures are actually willing to proceed with these kinds of bills. There really weren't any that were, there were a handful. I think North Dakota and Iowa had bills that had been successful, but really it was mostly a failed effort. So if you ask what's changed, in part, again, as you mentioned, it's largely the membership of the Supreme Court, which has encouraged some state legislators to kind of roll the dice and see if the court is willing to undo Roe v. Wade immediately. I think there have also been political shifts in the Trump era, in the sense that I think in a lot of these deeply red states, there's a belief that even if the Supreme Court were to strike these laws down, that sort of extremely anti-abortion base voters will reward these lawmakers for having passed these laws regardless. So it's sort of good politics, even if it's bad constitutional law. I think that's changed, too, in a way that you might not have seen several years ago.
And it's bad constitutional law under Casey, because Casey, again, is keyed in on viability. And prior to viability, the state cannot place an undue burden on a woman's right to get an abortion. Viability, as I think Justice O'Connor famously said some years ago, is a moving target. I mean, as medical science advances, the point of viability creeps earlier and earlier. You're more familiar with this area than I am. What is currently, is there a consensus now on roughly when viability occurs in a typical pregnancy?
I think it's 24 weeks. I'm just going to double check because it's a... I think, yeah, it said it really varies, I think, because it's contested. I think it, because the other reason, some studies say 22 weeks. It really depends partly on the weight of a premature baby. Mm-hmm. 24 weeks is usually the cutoff point that doctors use for trying to save a baby born prematurely. So that's still kind of the working date of viability, but there's studies showing a possibility of survival even younger.
Understood. Okay, so let's just use that as a benchmark, recognizing that there is some ambiguity and that there's individual variability, and perhaps even a baby that's born in a fancy hospital in New York City is going to be viable, whereas one born, with all due respect to North Dakota, in a small county in western North Dakota, might not be viable. So there are all sorts of uncertainties, but let's just use 24 weeks as a benchmark. Anytime you see one of these restrictions, then, that starts using a different benchmark that's way earlier than that, that's a direct contradiction of the holding in Casey.
Right. And I think one of the other striking things about these bills is not just that they're pre-viability bans, because a lot of earlier incremental restrictions were also pre-viability bans, but they're attempts to force the court to confront the validity of Roe and Casey. I think to some extent, a lot of what you saw in previous years focused on pre-viability bans, but that came later in pregnancy. And there, the idea was to expand on one of the court's relatively recent abortion decisions, Gonzalez versus Carhart, which upheld the Federal Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act. So the idea was that even though Gonzalez didn't authorize a kind of sweeping pre-viability ban in any way, it did involve abortions later in pregnancy. It did involve, for example, a ban of one specific kind of procedure, which became a very important strategy for anti-abortion lawyers a few years ago.
Overwhelming emotion on the ground in Alabama, sweeping across the country.
I don't know how we got here, both as a state and a nation, but it's both embarrassing and a little bit terrifying.
Who are you to tell me what to do with my body? It's my decision. It's not yours.
Tonight, the governor signing a bill into law effectively outlawing abortion in Alabama.
All human life is precious. You certainly cannot deter your efforts to protect the unborn because of cost.
We're here to fight for the rights of women to decide for themselves whether they want to have an abortion.
When it comes to women's rights with respect to their reproduction, I think you should leave it to women.
Making it a crime, even if the pregnancy was caused by rape or incest.
Pay attention to your legislators.
25 lawmakers who voted in favor, all white men.
Do you know what it's like to be raped?
No, ma'am, I don't.
Do you know what it's like to have a relative commit incest on you?
On me, no, ma'am.
Bill sparking intense partisan fights.
He did not make a motion!
He made a motion to table.
He did not make a motion!
Now we have a bill that could potentially force someone who's been a victim of rape or incest to carry a baby. A doctor in the state of Alabama at this point would go to jail longer than my rapist. Welcome to Alabama.
I apologize to the women of Alabama for this archaic law that we passed.
No law is constitutional until the Supreme Court actually revisits what Roe versus Wade.
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today my guest is Mary Ziegler of Florida State University's College of Law. She's an expert on the history of abortion, which is highly relevant to what's going on today. Stick around. And now it's time to finish our discussion with Mary Ziegler of Florida State University, who's written several books on the history of abortion. Now, obviously, abortion is, to a great extent, an adult subject, and we're about to get to some fairly specific and graphic details. So if there are small children around, you might want to move to another room. This is a very unpleasant aspect of abortion, but the so-called partial birth abortion is very, very late in pregnancy and literally involves extracting the head of the baby, which typically comes out first, and before the baby is fully born, actually destroying the baby, sucking the brains out, and then perhaps dismembering the rest of the body on its way out. And that, of course, was banned for the obvious reason that it's just very hard even to think about, and also because there was an argument that there was no medical necessity. If there is a baby that's almost ready to come out and can be born, then it should be born. And that's the federal statute, and the federal statute was upheld, as you say. The similar technique you're referring to that happens later in a pregnancy, but prior to the point of viability, is the so-called dilation extraction, correct?
It's actually dilation and evacuation. Excuse me. Usually the term that's used. And that's, obviously it would be very different to ban that
right.
Because dilation and evacuation, while one is not always performed later in pregnancy, mm-hmm. and two is the most common procedure after the first trimester. So it was not a kind of rare procedure the same way that partial birth abortion or that medically was called dilation and extraction the same way that was. But the idea was still to sort of be able to proceed incrementally. So the court would be ditching viability as the dividing line, and for example, saying we'll ban another procedure, a much more important procedure, or we'll ban abortion, for example, at 20 weeks.
Right.
But it wouldn't be in one fell swoop, and that the court could sort of, with a straight face, say that it was preserving what really mattered about Casey.
Right. And
while
again,
getting rid of viability.
I'm going to leave the gruesome details behind in a moment, but I think the correlation there that you were alluding to is that there is something that kind of looks like a baby, when you get closer to the point of viability, and that is destroyed in a way that's similar to what happens during a partial birth abortion. But as unpleasant as that is to contemplate, as you point out, that is one of the most common forms of abortion. So if you try to take mm-hmm. Carhartt and apply it to pre-viability dilations and evacuations, you can see how that people would think that way, but on the other hand, it really would be a blow toward anything but the very earliest abortions.
Right, and I think that was sort of, in my opinion, that was still a smarter strategy and potentially even a more effective strategy. Listeners may not know, but one of the cases that the Supreme Court has been acting weirdly about and considering for a while is another Alabama case that involves a ban on dilation and evacuation. So that may ultimately turn out to be consequential. But all of these laws, including bans on, they're called dismemberment abortion bans usually,
right.
Are all designed to allow the court often to jettison viability, but theoretically keep Casey so as to sort of save face and proceed more slowly. So what's changed recently is that lawmakers have said we have absolutely no interest in that. They literally use the word force the Supreme Court to reconsider Roe and Casey immediately and to ban abortions really early in pregnancy when there's lots of public support for legal abortion and when there's just no even vaguely plausible claim that Casey would permit that kind of law.
Yep, isn't it interesting? I think there's a parallel here. You've mentioned the incrementalists or moderates on the one hand who want to chip away at Roe and Casey, and then, of course, the absolutists who want to just take it up and take it out this year if possible. It's kind of an interesting parallel there. There are similar discussions on a very different topic right now, impeachment, and you've got Democrats who want to go out and start the impeachment inquiry yesterday and have an impeachment here in the next few months. whereas the Speaker of the House and the more moderates say, no, let's take our time, let's chip away at this, and let's build our case. It's a very similar phenomenon on both the left and the right in these two issues, isn't it?
It is. And the absolutist incrementalist divide, it really goes back to the 70s. And I think there's a parallel, too, in the sense that there's no actual difference in terms of what these two factions want. If, for example, you ask a sort of prototypical incrementalist group, do you think that abortion should be allowed in cases of rape or incest? They would almost all say no. They would all almost say it's wrong, it's unnecessary. But they think as a matter of kind of strategic savvy that sometimes you have to get half a loaf rather than none. And the absolutists, I think, in some ways think, one, that strategy is sort of counterproductive, that if you don't ask for what you want, you're not going to get it. And two, I think they also believe, wrongly or rightly, that the political moment has changed and that both the Supreme Court and, you know, national political leaders will be prepared to go much further with respect to abortion than they would have in previous years.
All right. So that's where we are. And now comes the time when I ask you to look into your crystal ball. What do you think is going to happen over the next weeks and months? Do you think the absolutists are correct in their assessment, or do you think maybe the moderates are, or what's going to happen?
I mean, I think it's always hard to predict just because, of course, everyone was wrong when it came to Casey. So I think there's still a possibility that the court will not overturn Roe v. Wade. That, of course, will turn largely on what John Roberts decides to do. I think if you were betting, you would bet that the Federalist Society had successfully screened out anyone who would choose to preserve Roe. So you would think that the court would, in fact, ultimately decide to undo Roe, maybe not in name, but certainly in substance. I think the absolutists got it wrong, though, in terms of the timeline. There's been very little signal that this Supreme Court wants to deal with abortion at all, much to speak of, much less to do so quickly and in a kind of dramatic way. So I think in terms of if Roe is going to be overturned, we're looking at more like 5 years down the road and a process that involves multiple decisions, multiple incremental laws, not just one showy decision upholding, for example, an outright ban on abortion.
You mentioned Chief Justice Roberts, and so let's expand on that a little bit. He, above all other people, but certainly the other justices as well, have to preserve the institution of the Supreme Court, which, of course, has no ability to force people to follow its decisions. It ultimately only has a very strong power of persuasion. And the other branches of government, especially the executive, have to support its decisions in order for them to be enforced. To the extent that the court is perceived as a purely political institution and that a change in personnel can lead to dramatic reversals of long-established precedent, that tends to undermine the court's legitimacy. So is that the primary reason that Justice Roberts is the swing vote here?
I think so. I mean, I think there's very little. I mean, we don't really know because there haven't been lots of Roberts' opinions on abortion, but there's nothing in his biography that would suggest that he would be supportive of abortion rights or that he would have think that Roe was rightly decided. But we do know he routinely speaks out against people who describe the court as a partisan institution, including President Trump. He's deeply concerned about the court's reputation, and I think specifically with his own legacy as Chief Justice, about how the court's reputation on his watch.
And
I think that's particularly true with sort of high salience, really visible matters like abortion. If you look, often Roberts will join the has recently joined the conservatives kind of routinely on matters, or, you know, at least without much fear, on matters that don't seem to be that publicly visible. But of course, abortion is. So there may be a kind of different calculus that comes in for him when the public is watching, rather than when the public doesn't really, you know, it's just obscure legalese that only people like you and I care about, you know?
Yeah. I recall just this last year when Trump was talking about Obama judges, and the Chief Justice said in a remarkably public rebuke, there are no Obama judges, there are no Bush judges or Republican judges or Democratic judges. You know, we're all just federal judges trying our best to decide the law. And that was a fairly high profile response to the president's remarks. And I'm kind of wondering if Trump has gotten himself into hot water in that regard by getting the Chief Justice's hackles up.
In a way, yes. I mean, I think that the Federalist Society chooses judges partly with an eye to ensuring that their philosophy will generate results that conservatives like. And I think Robert's overall sort of jurisprudential worldview still lines up with that. I think, again, it can be different when everyone is watching, and it can also be different in terms of how things happen. If you're talking about undoing a longstanding precedent very quickly, that would do much more damage to the court's reputation than something that is more incremental or even harder to understand. So I think if you're wondering how Roberts would go about undoing Roe, if that's something that's going to happen, it would be much more subtle and much more slow, partly because he has this stake in the court's reputation.
Well, Mary Ziegler of Florida State University, we obviously called the right person for an update on the status of abortion in our country. Can we call you again down the road when the next major development occurs?
Yeah, absolutely. No, not a problem.
Thank you for your time.
Okay, thanks.
So, Emily, it's always a pleasure to see you. Always a pleasure.
Likewise.
Well, I'm so very happy. And it's because you talk so much. That's why I enjoy talking with you, is because you're a woman of so many words.
It's true.
Do we have a quiz contestant on the line?
Yes.
Who are you?
Lauren from Ashland.
Lauren from Ashland, Virginia?
Yes.
That's tremendous. Well, thank you very much for playing today. Emily, do you have a good question for Lauren?
Of course I do. All my questions are good, Stuart.
Yeah, I've heard you say that before.
Yeah, well, it's still true.
Uh-huh.
All right, Lauren, which of the following scenarios would most likely be considered a violation of the Fourth Amendment?
Okay.
A suspect is interrogated without being informed of the right to an attorney. B, a person is tried twice for the same crime. C, a suspect's cell phone is analyzed by police before a warrant is issued. D, a person is prosecuted for a federal crime without a jury.
C.
Well, that was very quick. What was C again?
C was the cell phone.
Yes, a cell phone is analyzed by police before a warrant is issued.
Okay, what made that sort of a difficult question is that the other ones also violated other parts of the Constitution.
Yes, but not the Fourth Amendment.
Not the Fourth Amendment, exactly. So if you had a sense that, oh my gosh, they were all violations, then you were on the right track. But the question was specifically about the Fourth Amendment. Yeah, that's a huge issue. That was just decided a couple of years ago. And there was a guy, the police basically stopped this guy, and they found some incriminating evidence on his cell phone, and they used it to prosecute him. And in a very carefully considered decision, the Supreme Court basically said, you know, modern cell phones are essentially conduits into huge databases of private information, some of them even, you know, remotely connected. On my phone, for example, you can access my bank accounts if you have the passcode. So it's a very powerful thing, and we don't want the government going through all of our stuff, even if it doesn't involve a physical intrusion. It's very much an invasion of privacy. So very important decision. Was just talking about it, in fact, yesterday here with a bunch of law enforcement people, and they would have liked to be able to access that stuff without a warrant, but hey, you can get, you know, actually it brings up a really important thing. Did you know, I'm looking at Emily now, but Lauren, feel free to chime in.
Sure.
That bad guys can remotely erase information on a cell phone in the possession of the police?
That's not surprising.
I didn't know that, but it makes sense.
It does, which is, it's interesting then that that's the way that the court has ruled, that the cell phone would have to have a warrant before it could be searched, because I would think it would fall under similar law to vehicles, because they can do vehicle searches before they get a warrant, because the vehicle could disappear, but then so could digital
data. Well, there's apparently a technical solution. I think one solution is just to turn the phone off, and that's temporary. But then if you want the phone to be on, you put it in something called a Faraday box, which named after Michael Faraday, pioneer in electricity research, and that will actually block signals. But then you still have the problem that as long as it's in the Faraday box, you can't access anything except what's actually physically on the phone. So the cops really do find this a very inconvenient ruling, but too bad.
Stuart, wasn't the Carpenter case also that the records were controlled? They're controlled also by third parties.
That was, yes, that was a different case, though, wasn't it?
Oh, okay. I was thinking Carpenter.
But... with Carpenter is also involved cell phones, but in that
right.
case, they weren't trying to access what was on the phone. They were trying
right.
to access the locational information.
The location data, yeah.
Right. Did I get, I mean, is that the question you had? I'm looking at you, Emily. Did I reference the wrong case? What was your answer choice again?
No, C is correct.
C was
I just
right.
was thinking
it was...
of Carpenter.
Right, but I'm just curious as to which case the answer choice C was referencing. What is answer
I
choice C again?
I did not reference any specific
No, that's okay. One. What is answer choice C? Just read it to me if you would, please.
A suspect's cell phone is analyzed by police before a warrant is issued.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about. Carpenter was about locational data, which you get from
data.
A third party. And that was also an enormous case. Several years ago in the Jones case, the court ruled that when the police clandestinely put a GPS tracker
right.
on someone's car, without a warrant, that was a violation. And then in a similar vein, they said when the police access, you know, Verizon's data that can pinpoint your location for the past year to within a few feet, that was also a violation of the Fourth Amendment unless they got a warrant. So all very important cases, all very cutting edge technology. And again, that's what we were talking about at our cop thing recently. Well, Lauren, thank you very much for playing. Since you won, send us a message on our Facebook page. Just go to Facebook and Your Weekly Constitutional. Send us a message with your T-shirt size and your
okay.
and we will send you both and send us and your mailing address, and we will send you both a pocket constitution and a YWC T-shirt.
No, oh, that's awesome. Thanks so much, Stuart.
Thank you,
Emily.
Lauren.
Thanks, Lauren. Bye.
Bye.
James Madison was president during the War of 1812, a conflict which saw Madison briefly take up arms himself with militia fighting the British. In the Deep South, however, the U.S. Army forged an unlikely alliance against the British. In the weeks leading up to the British attack on New Orleans, General Andrew Jackson met with French pirate Jean Lafitte to make a deal. Lafitte and his men would defend the port city in exchange for pardons from the United States government. Lafitte and a handful of his lieutenants strengthened the defensive lines around the city and provided artillery support for American forces, successfully repelling the advancing British in the process. In the aftermath of the battle, Andrew Jackson praised the valor of Lafitte's men and promptly requested full pardons for Lafitte and the men serving with him. On February 6, 1815, the United States government granted pardons to Jean Lafitte and his associates. This is Tyler Stanley with your Madison Minute.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Mary Ziegler, the Stearns Weaver Miller Professor at Florida State University's College of Law, who's written several books about the history of abortion. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check them out on SoundCloud. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.